we'll have a quiz next time. I thought we had said the A's, so.
My apologies if I
disappoint you.
Okay. Isn't that sad?
Well, we continue to parse our way through the grand question, Tolstoy or Dostoevsky, the great confrontation, and realize, I think, as we go along that, you know, at least while we're reading Tolstoy, I think we don't have to and we shouldn't take sides. They are, we've stressed enough the difference. You yourself can witness the difference of these authors, and we really do have to think of them as representing two different lines of the literary tradition. Tolstoy, if anything, inherits more from the classical side, and Dostoevsky more from the Old Testament and Christianity. Tolstoy is about serenity, balance, harmony with the cosmos, moral accountability, character. Dostoevsky, all those things are thrown out the window. Imbalance, energy, light and darkness, a grander world than you had suspected, a world in which morality is, but kind of beside the point. Morality, immorality is something that's happened and you have to be accountable for, but it's not the big story, right? All those things are part of Dostoevsky, and neither of these is a world that is passing out of being or has become unfashionable or something. These are part of what continues then into the 20th century. With Tolstoy, we think of the well-made novel in part, although I caution careful historians of the novel, because Henry James referred to Tolstoy's novels as loose, baggy monsters. He was not a fan. He was, of course, a worshiper of Turgenev, right, as you will recall. But there's something, Tolstoy is very much the master of the detail that tells, right? And you might remember the button. You remember the button? I don't know if you remember the button, but it's in book one, chapter 19, page 60, if you have the Norton and my different translation. But it begins, when Anna went into the room, Dolly was sitting in the little drawing room with a white-headed, fat little boy, already like his father, giving him a lesson in French reading. As the boy read, he kept twisting and trying to tear off a button that was nearly off his jacket. His mother had several times taken his hand from it, but the fat little hand went back to the button again. His mother pulled the button off and put it in her pocket. End of button. Button never reappears, right? That is it. And if it had been Dostoevsky, the button would only be even mentioned if it were fatal in somebody's death, you know. That's the only reason. The same about nature. Nature is described in its own terms in Tolstoy to revel in its own details, right? In Dostoevsky, it's only important if somebody falls off a mountain or sees a transcendent waterfall falling off the mountain or something like that. So very, very different. But that notion of the detail, now what's important about that button? And incidentally, Dostoevsky knew about that button. I kid you not, and you will remember this. If you search your memory, there's a moment in Ivan's dialogue with the devil where the devil is talking about some brass buttons, and he said, exactly like those magnificent ones by Count Leo Tolstoy.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
So they knew each other, and of course, Dostoevsky loved getting his digs in with people that he respected as well as those he didn't. So, but the idea behind the button is a non-symbolic detail, right? It's a non-symbolic detail. It is what John Crow Ransom would come to call irrelevant texture. And to him was a hallmark of modern art, modern poetry, of good modern poetry. He said, what is his exact terms?
Rich.
Rich something structure, what is it?
let's see.
Irrelevant, local. Local, texture. There's something about structure and texture at any rate that makes the work. The structure is terribly important. The work has to be structured magnificently. Right? It has to be a reflection of a world, right? But there has to be also, for Ransom, the detail that was not expected, is not part of the design, the sign of the real. Right? To him, this in an essay called Poetry, a Note in Ontology. And indeed, for Ransom, it's an ontological question. And it's one we might say that in this, Henry James and he shook hands, concerned with the ontological status of the work of art. It's something that is it something that expresses our understanding of being as being, right? Which is a great concern, not just to someone who had read Heidegger, but to many. It became an enormous question for modernists, the sense of the loss of being and the need to recover a sense of being. So this has its atheist and its orthodox sides. In addition to Ransom, we go back to Henry James again. James said of the art of the novelist, be one of the few on whom nothing is lost. Right. So, on the one hand, you say that the button is an irrelevant detail. On the other hand, it does serve a purpose, doesn't it? What purpose does it serve? What does it fatten up? What does it weigh down in our imagination? And it's not an onion, no, it's just a button.
It finalizes us. You know, we can build these structures and these tensions of Dostoevsky, but like another one of the tensions is that at the end of the day we're also real and we do act and we don't just perceive.
I think that's part of it, yeah. Mm-hmm. Any other ideas? It seems to me, though, that this contributes to the whole notion of domesticity that goes throughout the novel, through marriage, what the wife and mother is doing. This is Dolly's child, and so in a sense it's going to redound on Anna. The neglect she gives her own child, all of that is part of the whole picture, right? And the lines are never drawn, right? The lines are never drawn, but they're there.
He does, though, like, it does come back to the fact that she teaches her children French and reads to them in French,
mm-hmm.
like through Levin.
Yes. Good point. Yeah. No, you're right. But the duties of mother toward child are get compounded as we go on through the novel. It's been said that Tolstoy. Well, again, I said James was not a great admirer of Tolstoy. Yes, Patrick.
In what sense does Ransom use irrelevant? I'm just curious.
And it uses that as a provocative word, of course. But in other words, it's irrelevant to the design that you might. That the artist might have.
Irrelevant okay. is countered by the adjective rich. Rich, irrelevant texture.
That goes.
Yeah.
Something.
Pretty sure.
I should have looked this up before.
It's been a long time.
Yeah. But it haunts you.
Yeah, but the idea is that the texture, the word texture is the important one. And the point is that it seems irrelevant. But there's something grainy, you know, there's the graininess of life in it, the graininess of experience. It isn't always predictable. It's not always tied up in a neat package. I think that's what he means by it. And structure is something we feel is imposed.
Yes.
So would you say that Dostoevsky, in this sense, is neat? I mean, in the sense that...
Oh, no, gosh, nobody ever called Dostoevsky neat. He's a loose baggy monster too.
Oh, he is. Yeah, but he pays all his details, doesn't he? Pays them over time. Yeah. Yes, huh?
I kind of hesitate to say this. It's kind of a whole can of worms, but it seems a little bit analogous to what we were saying about the polydigmatic. Just threads. I was thinking about like Ratikin talking about the champagne being, you know, lukewarm, kind of an irrelevant texture like that that mm-hmm. frames his work.
It doesn't seem immediately important,
right.
But it tells you something about his character.
Mm-hmm.
And this happens a great deal. There are so many similarities between Tolstoy and Dostoevsky,
mm-hmm.
as a matter of fact, that the differences are all the more striking, because if they had never arisen, I think the Russian novel would have looked very different to us,
mm-hmm.
despite Gogol and Turgenev.
Yes, oh, absolutely, absolutely. I was going to say, where did Dostoevsky heritage goes in the 20th century? Certainly to Faulkner, on the one hand, right? And then perhaps through them both, to magical realism, right? The extravagant senses of art and not the well-contained and well-controlled notions of art. Faulkner is not so much extravagant, although Garcia Marquez claims to have gotten so much from Faulkner. But rather the notion of storytelling, the notion of dialogue. I look back at, I was teaching Go Down Moses today to the sophomores, and I shouldn't do this, but I imposed the entire novel on them. And the great section 4 of The Bear is that long dialogue that might very well be between Ivan and Alyosha. You know, it's that kind of structure, and Faulkner has learned that. And how to use that in the novel from Dostoevsky. So these oppositions continue the classic side from Tolstoy. And incidentally, another little detail that kind of complicates this: one can see go around the stage prop and look at the back of it. And this is suggested by a little essay that Roland Barthes wrote about Tolstoy called The Reality Effect, right? L'effet du réel, in which he says, he takes a passage at the very beginning of The Death of Ivan Illich, and it's a somber scene. The body's lying in state and people are coming to visit. And the point of the scene is that all the people, Tolstoy kind of follows, the camera pans. Tolstoy is very cinematic, isn't he? Mm-hmm. The camera pans out as they walk out from seeing the body, and the men pop open a cigar or unbutton their vest or something and talk more frankly. And of course, it has nothing to do with any appreciation for the dead man and so forth. So it's kind of the callousness of life goes on. But he said there's a sentence presenting the dead body that is, according to Barthes, is the core of Tolstoy's supposed art of realism, right? It begins something like, the dead man lay as dead men always lie, right, in this coffin and so forth. He says, Tolstoy's trick is that he enlists you in it, right? He enlists you in it. He says, you know how it is? You know how it is that you see when dead people are lying? Well, that's how he was, right? So he presents almost a picture of Tolstoy as con man. I think it's overdone, but as with Barthes always, it's quite a performance. There is something a bit blunt about Tolstoy, you know, that makes him not the finest of connoisseurs of the well-made novel. But there's something quite powerful in that bluntness as well. And he himself was conscious of the reputation of being a master of technique, right? And so he has his response to that in this novel. I don't know if you've gotten there yet. I hope that you have. But in book 5, chapter 11, there's Anna and Vronsky meet the painter, right? And it's I know your page number. Hold on, let me see if I can find mine. I have this. 431, 433. And in that, on page 431, you will find it. How do you say? Golyanishchev or Golyanishchev?
Golyanishchev, I think.
Golyanishchev. Yes, yes, wonderful, chimed in Godenishchev and Anna. In spite of his elation, this remark about technique, right, Vronsky has said this. And Vronsky, of course, you know, is the mouthpiece of the banal, of Poshlost, of the superfluous man in our motifs throughout the 19th century Russian novel. This is technique, said Vronsky. Yes, yes, wonderful, chimed in Goyenishchev and Anna. In spite of his elation, this remark about technique grated painfully on Mikhailov's heart. And glancing angrily at Vronsky, he suddenly frowned. He often heard the word technique mentioned and did not at all understand what was meant by it. He knew it meant a mechanical capacity to paint and draw, quite independent of the subject matter. He had often noticed, as now when his picture was being praised, that technique was contrasted with inner quality, as if it were possible to paint well something that was bad. He knew that much attention and care were needed not to injure one's work when removing the wrappings that obscure the idea. Interesting, huh? And that all wrappings must be removed, but as to the art of painting, the technique, it did not exist. If the things he saw had been revealed to a little child or to his cook, they would have been able to remove the outer shell from their idea. And the most experienced and technical painter could never paint anything by means of mechanical skill alone if the outline of the subject matter did not first reveal itself to his mind. Moreover, he saw that if technique were spoken of, then he could not be praised for it. In all he painted and ever had painted, he saw defects that were an eyesore to him, results of carelessness in removing the shell of the idea, which he could not now remedy without spoiling the work as a whole. And in almost all the figures and faces, he saw traces of wrappings that had not been entirely removed, and that spoiled the picture. So this is Tolstoy's rebuttal, right? Concentrate too much on technique, on the perfection of the method, and you wind up being a bourgeois, one of the demi-monde. And then two pages further, then he goes on and takes apart the word talent as well. And again, Vronsky has been praising him for what talent is shown, right? And the artist here is someone Tolstoy has given to be a real artist, someone who, for whom the act, the energeia that makes a work of art is one, for which feeling and restraint are harmonized and not mechanized, right? And not talent, not self-expression, right? But rather self-sacrifice, giving of the whole soul into the work itself. And so he takes these two chapters and you know, preaches a little bit about what for him the work of art is, conscious no doubt of his own reputation as a master of technique. So anyway, that's some of what strikes me as some of the difference here in Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, and it continues to our day. Yeah?
Is that the same message he's trying to give with the idea of the peasants as kind of artists and their ability to use scythes and their ability to mold?
Yeah, I think so.
What is he trying to say there about the connection between farming and art?
For him, the truth is always to be found out there among the simple simple peasants and so forth. But yeah, it's very true. The scythe, that whole, those two chapters in which we follow Levin trying to relearn the art of mowing, you know, is very profound in that way because he's fighting the scythe until he gets the right rhythm. And it is the oneness of assertion and restraint. And it, when it happens, the self gets completely submerged, right? It's no longer there. It's as though the scythe is mowing itself. So that is certainly another metaphor for art, but it's his one. I had suggested last time it's Levin's discovery of the oneness with the cosmos, but it's both. It's a good example. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, the lawnmower wasn't mass produced until 1880, and this is why we all have lawns now. Because having a scythe requires a great deal of discipline and control. Yeah. And the point here is the artist has his technique, the peasant has his technique. Why is the artist given all this prestige when in fact the peasant, you know, who knows how to do this might be considered just as much a technical key. And then the lawnmower democratizes it, so now the artist is hasn't lost his prestige as a result.
The work of lawns in the age of mechanical reproducibility.
Yes, it do.
Okay. All right. So yes. Uh huh.
Oh, what is relevant texture, but technique, right? Because it doesn't come from real characters. That's the whole point. It seems like it's entirely technical and doesn't. It's just shell. It seems like Tolstoy's, maybe it's sort of a paradoxical thing, but I don't know. Is he contradicting himself here in rebutting technique, right?
Uh-huh.
That which doesn't come from.
Yes. Right. No. I know exactly. I mean, I think this is the very point that he's making: is that it's not the irrelevant detail is not irrelevant, and it's not technique. It's not, well, I need some irrelevant texture here, so I'm going to lay it on thick, you know. Although sometimes we suspect him of that, you know. But I think no. I think this is his credo, that if it has a rough texture, it's because it's real, and I'm unwrapping it. You have to be careful unwrapping it, but you got to unwrap it.
It's very different from the French Impressionists, who are contemporary with this novel, and who have a texture, all right, but it's a texture that came out of optics and the invention of photography. Whereas I think in Tolstoy, it's a very different kind of realism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, yes, Kristen.
What do we do then with Levin's new farming strategies? I mean, because that seems to also have a great deal to do with this question of technique. What he's wanting to do is improve the technique of his workers.
Well, I mean, I think there's a contrast with Sergei, who has his schemes, which are the fashionable ones and don't work, right? And then Levin's, which arise out of consultation, mosaic wisdom of, you know, how to divide things among the peasants and so forth, right? Solomonic.
You know who's contemporary with Levin in this respect, though, is Taylor. And you say, who? If you've ever heard of Taylorism, he was the inventor of the assembly line. And so that's what Levin at first is thinking.
Uh-huh.
You know, get all these peasants lined up here, and it'll be efficient.
Yeah. All right, well, anyway. So, but lest we get... lost
much.
In technique, mowed too much, mowed down, mowed down by technique. We still have a magnificent novel, and one we need to discuss. We need to discuss its characters, and to look at them carefully. We have to begin with Anna, our tragic heroine, our title character, and the kind of attention he gives to her in. In book one, chapter 29, as she is on the train going back from Moscow to Petersburg, and
page 91,
about page 91. Thank you. She remembered the ball, remembered Vronsky and his face of slavish adoration. Remembered all her conduct with him. There was nothing shameful. 92, thank you. She said, well, what is it? She said to herself resolutely, shifting her seat in the lounge. What does it mean? Am I afraid to look it straight in the face? Why, what is it? Can it be that between me and this officer boy there exist or can exist any other relations than such as are common with every acquaintance? But he goes on, right? She felt her eyes opening wider and wider, her fingers and toes twitching nervously. Something within oppressing her breathing, while all shapes and sounds seemed in the uncertain half-light to strike her with unaccustomed vividness. Moments of doubt were continually coming upon her when she was uncertain whether the train were going forwards or backwards, or were standing still altogether, whether it were Anushka at her side or a stranger. What's that on the arm of the chair, a fur cloak or some beast? And what am I myself or some other woman? But Tolstoy is doing several things at once, right? Again, using the momentum of the train, right, as a kind of ominous undertone. At another level, it's her passions. It's a sign of her own passions. her own estrangement from them and from herself, right, suggested also by this alienation of the train. Some of the grotesque transformations of things, is this a fur cloak or some beast, right? As the world begins to be transformed in her imagination. She was afraid of giving way to this delirium, but something drew her towards it, and she could yield to it or resist it at will. She got up to rouse herself, and so forth. But then everything grew blurred again. That peasant with the long waist seemed to be gnawing something on the wall. So it's some very bad vibes in some of the images that are generated in it. The old lady began stretching her legs the whole length of the carriage and filling it with a black cloud. And there was a fearful shrieking and banging as though someone were being torn to pieces. And we get that motif, of course, quite explicitly later on. And actually one that's already happened at this point. And there was a blinding dazzle of red fire before her eyes, and a wall seemed to rise up and hide everything. Anna felt as though she were sinking down, but it was not terrible but delightful. The voice of a man muffled up and covered with snow shouted something in her ear. So, Tolstoy wants to put us within Anna as much as possible in order for this drama to be that experience of confusion, of lostness, of being taken up by the passions, and not loss of orientation, not a clear sign that this is all something to be afraid of, but then an attraction toward it at the same time. The whole novel tracks pretty smoothly from this little moment on the train as she lets things go on in that direction. Now, if you move on to, I think we've looked at this scene already, but in book 2, chapter 11, Vronsky and Anna have made love for the first time, and this is described, you might remember, as murder. If we think, on the one hand, that Tolstoy has read Shakespeare and has learned something of the art of the ominous at the beginning of a tragedy, such as Macbeth or Hamlet, signs and omens in the heavens and in nature and so forth that seem to precede terrible things. He's also learned from Dante, right? And we think very strongly of the circle of the lustful in the Inferno, where we have our souls there are driven about, restless, unable to stop, unable to rest, constantly driven, right? And we have Paolo and Francesca, and the very kinds of classic analysis of damnable desire that Dante gives us in Paolo and Francesca is reenacted in a sense in here in Anna and Vronsky, as they're driven together and increasingly have nothing but each other to fall back on, to fall into, to fall toward, and the rest of the world is steadily shut out from that. So the sign that this sense of murder, and then in book 2, chapter 22, as she looks at her son there, and Anna and Vronsky realize that they are in their affair, they're inevitably going in the wrong direction. They said it's like seeing an island that you can't get to, and your current is carrying you inevitably away. You can't reach some of your destination that you need to reach, which is the sun. And they can't see him. They can't see that until they see how the impact of Vronsky on her own son is.
What page is this?
169, 170. Thank you. That's chapter 22, book 2. Now then, if we move on to, of course, then there's the race course accident, and as her reaction to Vronsky's fall, and her at that moment where she finally discloses the affair to Karenin, to Alexei. Then we see her in book 3, and this is on your page 262. This is book 3, chapter 15, as we again go inside her mind and see her feelings. And on the second sentence, on the way home from the races, she had told her husband the truth in a moment of excitement, and in spite of the agony she had suffered in doing so, she was glad of it. After her husband had left her, she told herself that she was glad that now everything was made clear, and at least there would be no more lying and deception. But she goes on. It goes on in the third paragraph. When she thought of Vronsky, it seemed to her that he did not love her. That he was already beginning to be tired of her. That she could not offer herself to him. That, and she felt bitter against him for it. In a couple of paragraphs later, after Anushka went out, but Anna did not begin dressing. She repeated continually, "My God, my God." But neither God nor my had any meaning to her. The idea of seeking help in her difficulty in religion was as remote from her as seeking help from Alexei Alexandrovich himself. Although she had never had doubts of the faith in which she had been brought up, she knew that the support of religion was possible only upon condition of renouncing what made up for her the whole meaning of life. She was not simply miserable. She began to feel alarm at the new spiritual condition, never experienced before, in which she found herself. She felt as though everything were beginning to be double in her soul, just as objects sometimes appear double to overtired eyes. So, and Tolstoy evokes this sense of, you know, there are, and again, there are two worlds that she senses, that she's moved into a different world completely from her husband and from the world of you know, of decent society and of morality as well. So that it appears as a kind of lack of focus. She hardly knew at times what it was she feared and what she hoped for, whether she feared or desired what had happened or what was going to happen, and exactly what she longed for she could not have said. And this is a chapter in which she sees her son, she cries over what's happened or what's happening, and makes up her mind to run off at that moment with Vronsky and starts to pack. And then in the next chapter, Karenin's letter comes and she realizes she can't do that. It's all a good deal graver than she had thought, and so she unpacks. So it's this terrific back and forth action, indecision, desolation, doubles. Everything is double. Loss of focus has already set in for Anna. All right, but then, all right, we have a moment that seems like things could turn around as she has her baby, right, and at her lying in, there are terrible complications. She thinks she's dying. And we move to it's book 4, chapter 17, page 372 for you. Karenin comes, and she passionately begs his forgiveness for him. And so, as he comes in, she's saying, "For Alexei, I'm speaking of Alexei Alexandrovich. Alexei would not refuse me. I should forget. He would forgive. But why doesn't he come? He's so good. He doesn't know himself how good he is. Ah, my God, what agony. Give me some water, quick."
And 372?
So 372. Mm-hmm. This is book 4, chapter 17. And she goes on to say, again, this doubleness figure that runs throughout the novel. "Wait a minute, you don't know. Stay a little, stay." She stopped as though collecting her ideas. "Yes," she began, "yes, yes, yes. This is what I wanted to say. Don't be surprised at me. I'm still the same. But there is another woman in me. I'm afraid of her. She loved that man, and I tried to hate you and could not forget about her that used to be. I'm not that woman. Now I'm my real self, all myself. I'm dying now. I know I shall die," and so forth. "Only one thing I want. Forgive me quite." And all of this, of course, has a big impact on Karenin. and she makes him and Vronsky make up, right? All of this, and it's so emotionally overloaded, of course, that it makes you kind of suspect it and fear it. But at the same time, it's a moment in which there might be a turning point. There might have been indeed a turning point. Right? So all of this seems to issue in a moment of resolution in which she's not going to see Vronsky again, and so forth. But right, there's, you know, people intervene, and also she really doesn't love her husband that much, it seems. And now she says whereas she has forgiven him and been forgiven by her, now she begins to hate him for his virtue. And
she owes him one.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So so then quite quickly, by the end of book four, you see, Anna and Vronsky are back together, and then off they go. No divorce, right? Just a runaway together, and we have the classic all for love affair. Right. In book five, quickly, a quick change. As in chapter eight, it says Anna with Vronsky is unpardonably happy, but by chapter 13, they're saying life in Italy is tedious. Right, and it sort of goes downhill from there. We can see where this wonderful Italian holiday is going to go by that time. So, and that's where we've gotten to this point. Now, so Anna, you know, Tolstoy, I think, maintains our sympathy with Anna throughout, puts us in her shoes, more or less, and the kind of pressure, the kind of crisis that she constantly lives within. And yet we see, you know, just exactly what she's done that is has gotten her into the world that she now finds herself in. And more, right, we see her more or less almost forced to choose self, often in the guise of choosing her lover, rather than making decision. Now, a lot of this depends on what we think of Karenin, doesn't it? Of Alexei Alexandrovich. So, can I hear some opinions on Karenin? Because this is always worth a good deal of discussion. Well, Kristen, I saw quite an immediate reaction from you. What do you think?
Well, I mean, it's the way I felt about Karenin before the reconciliation scene, was different, because the tenderness that he shows to the little girl and the care and concern that he has for his family, I mean, he really is, at that point in time, he is a man with sort of a no-win situation, because Anna detests him at this point, and even though he does, after that point, seem to genuinely be concerned about her future if she runs off with Vronsky. But there's also sort of like this malevolent undercurrent to everything that he does. The Latin quotation, the quos vult perdere.
Dementat.
Yeah, it's funny because our translation said, whom God wishes to punish, he makes mad. But God actually isn't part of that sentence in the Latin. And so like it's kind of like the epigram again, where, you know, the vengeance is mine, but it's not connected. So
in the Latin, it's actually plural.
Yeah.
It should be, right. It's from the Greek, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the gods, yeah.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. So there's like this undercurrent that maybe, even though he seems to be genuinely having a Christian, you know, caritas type concern for his wife, it's not entirely sure, so I don't know how I feel about it.
Okay. All right. Yeah, Marjorie? You were, and then.
Okay.
And then,
yeah. Okay. Well, I was just thinking that Karenin seems as though he has a genuine love for Anna, and he really is hurt that she leaves him for Vronsky. But it also seems as though he's so dictated by propriety that whenever he speaks of her to her about it, he never brings his personal feelings into it, but focuses solely on duty. And in that way, Anna believes that he only cares about duty. But mm-hmm. I think that because his pride is so injured by it, mm-hmm. leaving her, he is unwilling to, open himself up to that vulnerability of, I really do love you. Mm-hmm. So it seems so, when he presents it to her.
But isn't it in part also because he's afraid what he will say is, I really do hate you, right?
Right, yeah. And it seems as though with that, like, love and hate, how
mm-hmm.
how opposite they are, but how close they are at the same time. So she's betrayed his love, and now he hates her with this sort of gross, but love.
I find him sort of spineless and easily dictated by what other people, or maybe not by what other people desire, but he just doesn't seem to have any backbone. What I'm thinking of is when the woman who comes and helps, what's her name? Countess Ivanovna. She just sort of like comes in and does whatever, even though she admits that she has no management skills, he still lets her come into the house and take control of his son. And granted, he doesn't have anybody, but then when Anna writes the letter, even though he wants to let Anna in, she says, no, you can't do this. And she does present an argument of, we've told him that she's dead, but he just lets her come in and take control of everything, and he doesn't ever put his own foot down. And I think that's reflected in his relationship with Anna also.
Part of it is how strong our society's dictates, right? And I think as Americans, we want to say, well, I can be myself. Right? I can be a proud individual no matter what. But I think that's not the emphasis of the book, but we should look at these scenes a little more carefully. Go ahead.
I do agree with Katie that Cranon is a bit spineless, but I think in spite of him being spineless and not very romantic at all, I think he is far superior to Vronsky.
Mm-hmm.
Just because he's more respectable, he's more well-behaved, and Vronsky is like flirting with the other girl who thought he was going to propose and then runs off with Anna, and now Anna thinks he's about to drop her. And also just, to me, a very crucial part of loving somebody
mm-hmm.
is you have to respect that person. And if I was already married or engaged or whatever, which I'm not, and some guy came up to me and started hinting, you know, you want to go off and I said no, and he said, okay, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that, I would have gotten over it and just said, okay, so he's a little bit passionate, he just can't control himself. But the fact that Anna keeps saying no, and Vronsky keeps saying, don't you love me, babe? That alone to me would think, if I was her and I was having any feelings for him, that would destroy it. Because he is being appalled and she says stop and he won't. So I cannot see how she could have gone for him after all of that.
All right. I especially like your point about respect, that he does show respect for his wife. And don't you think Tolstoy goes out of his way to say, to make it not a very attractive, not a very sexy respect that he shows for her? You
yes,
know,
that's true.
So that we have to face something in ourselves, that we ourselves want, desire, have to have this romantic fix. And yet, what is it that really makes marriages? I think the novel is very much about that very question. So that's good. Yeah, there was a hand up in back.
Just going to say, kind of in response to what she said about Anna says no, but he knows that she's making herself say no, and she really wants to say yes. Just in the whole seduction part, like
certainly
he knows, like when she makes that whole big statement about like, leave me alone, go apologize. It's like at that point he's like, oh, there's hope.
Yeah. No. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She didn't kick me in the shin.
Angela, go
just
ahead.
Just a side note. Who is the translator of your edition?
That's Garnett.
I think it's Garnett. Yeah.
There
seems to be a lot of difference between that translation and this one.
Yeah, there are.
I'm sorry, I like Garnett. But I assigned Gibeon.
The Garnett
I like
is
the
actually
Norton.
Closer, word for word, to the Russian. Apart from, you know, errors, but everybody makes errors. You know, the thing you have to bear in mind with this society, or maybe most societies, but here, it's okay to be adulterous, you just keep it secret. And that's where Karenin ends
mm-hmm.
up before the birth of the daughter. you know, because that's the way his society thinks. There's adultery all over the place, probably, but you don't make it public. Everybody keeps it hidden. And we see what happens when you don't do this later. I don't think we've quite got to
right.
that point, have we?
No, no.
Or
no.
We presume you haven't,
yeah.
Let's put it that way.
Yeah. But the father, I mean, the husband is also the head of the household, the father of the family, and the outcome on the child is always something that has to be taken into
yeah.
account. The good name of the family and so forth, all those things are factors that aren't, that passion doesn't want to think of, or whether it's the passion of love or the passion of you know, being jilted and wanting revenge. Yeah.
I was going to say, all the same, I mean, there's something profoundly sad about him. You know, several times Tolstoy mm-hmm. says, you know, for the first time, he actually had to think about his own life.
Yes.
You know, that he's
mm-hmm.
constantly
right.
imprisoned by societal roles and expectations, particularly
mm-hmm.
his career. And I really think he imagines that's where life is to be found, and I think he doesn't really understand how bad of a husband he's been until the adulterous affair happens. I think he thinks that their marriage is what a marriage in his society at his level is, you know, and so there's something, I think he's definitely the victimized here, you know, as much as he is, you know, hurt Anna, you know, it's definitely cuts both ways, and I think, at least for me reading it, it does draw sympathy towards him, you know, that he is a very unreflective man, and I think the most tragic thing is when he pulls away from his own son and starts to call him young man and
yeah.
everything
mm-hmm.
to show that he really does not know how to love, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I think the second baby is a re-opportunity for him to learn to love.
Uh-huh.
And to
so he's a man without insight into the human heart, as it were, but a man of duty, right? And so are we just content with saying, well, this is the romantic age and so duty doesn't count for anything? Are we content in saying this was not a good marriage?
It may not be an ideal marriage, but it's far better than what she has with Vosky.
Certainly. All right. I don't think we have the evidence that it was a bad marriage.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we have the evidence that it was a bad marriage. Please.
Kind of a mediocre marriage.
Yeah.
But that doesn't make it bad. It's,
right.
it's what
she seems like she just got bored.
Yeah.
And boredom isn't like a reason to.
Right.
You know.
No, it's not. No, it's not.
Well, look, you know, the thing that we see in the novel is that it represents a shift in her perception in the world. She sees the world very differently after she meets Vronsky. Things look different. There's the famous example of his ears.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
She's never noticed that before because she's put them out of her mind. And so the real question is, when one of these transforming moments occurs, when suddenly you're forced to look at the world differently from the way you'd been looking at it, how do you act? That's the real question. What do you make of that brave new world that has such people in it? With big ears.
Marjorie.
It seems to me that the ultimate failure of the marriage is not necessarily that it's a particularly bad marriage in the beginning, but when Anna starts moving away with Vronsky, Karenin reacts so passively to the whole thing. And, you know, seeing her at the races and how she's like, oh, I don't care, but he... And when it's interesting to me that it's Betsy talking to Oblonsky about it, but she says that either he must take her away acting energetically or must divorce her. So, like, either one decisive action or the other. But it seems like the whole problem is that he's not decisive with Anna. I mean, the decisive move he makes finally is pushed. Anna pushes him by inviting Vronsky to her house, and then he says, oh, well, now you've broken the laws of propriety. Now I'm going to divorce you, but then, no, you can do what you want on the side. But it seems as though in that scene when she has just had a child and she's in bed and saying, please forgive me, I love you, that it seems as though if he had been assertively, yes, I love you too, I want this to work, you have to stop seeing me.
He basically does.
Yeah, well, except
at that point.
Later he says, you can carry on with Vronsky, I'm not going to divorce you.
No, he says, you have to give up Vronsky, I'm not going to divorce you. Am I wrong?
The first time were you talking?
No, we're talking about after her near death.
After,
you know, because there's that moment in which they seem to be reconciled, right? Where
page 379 is
uh-huh.
roughly where we. Wait a minute. Let's see.
Uh-huh.
He forgave his wife. He forgave.
Let's see.
As time went on, this is on 382, he saw more and more clearly that however natural his position might appear to him at the time, he would not be allowed to remain in it. He was conscious that beside the good spiritual force which governed his soul, there existed a coarse power as potent, if not more so, and that this power would not grant him the humble peace he desired. He felt that everybody looked at him with questioning surprise without understanding him.
All that's expecting
something from him, and especially is aware of the insecurity and artificiality of his relation with his to his wife.
Mm-hmm.
So
all of that's fairly late.
The next paragraph says Karenin began to notice that Anna feared him, was oppressed by his presence, and avoided looking at him straight in the eyes. So
we should look at that. That certainly that chapter, and the next chapter, as he talks about a brutal force that is pushing on him, not letting him do what he would want to do. But we have to ask also the question: does he change? And I think that you all have somewhat addressed this question already. I think he is a character who changes. And part of the tragedy of Anna Karenina is that her one decision deforms others as well. It has a ripple effect that certainly goes to his husband and makes him not and changes him in a way that he would not otherwise be. But that he finds himself with that brutal foresight, he finds himself much like Anna and Vronsky, and they see her son and they find themselves sailing away from him without being able to get back to him. There's something inevitable taking them away, taking charge of them, and not allowing them to do as they would like to do. And this is true with Karenin as well. Yeah.
Sorry, I found this passage that I've been looking for.
Okay.
On the bottom of 377, and this is where he and Vronsky are talking, I guess, right outside of the room, but he says, "That is my position. You may trample me in the mud, make me the laughing stock of the world. I will not forsake her and will never utter a word of reproach to you."
Mm-hmm.
Brennan talking to Vronsky. "My duty is clearly defined. I must and will remain with her. If she wishes to see you, I will let you know. But now I think it would be best for you to leave."
That's so, right. Yeah.
So it seems as though what he's saying, I will yield to her decision if she wishes to be with you, but I will remain with her. And on 387, he says, He considered it better for Anna to break off the relationship with Vronsky.
Yeah.
But if everyone thought of this impossible, he was even ready to allow those relations to be renewed, so long as no slur was there but bad cast on the children, etc. So that he's passively allowing the affair with Vronsky to continue instead of aggressively cutting it off. So if she wants you, I'll send for you. I mean, yeah, leave now, but don't. He's not saying leave now and never come to see my wife again. Leave now, but you know, if she wants you, I'll send for you. I mean, do you see what I'm saying?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Also, this is something that he becomes,
mm-hmm.
right? And he also becomes kind of the opposite as he goes on, right? So that we see a volatile series of changes that are all wrought by one original decision. If we start thinking about, you know, by the end of book two, she has told him straight out that she's having an affair. And we have that scene at the race course in which he finds himself being very formal with her, more than he would want to be because of he's been so offended by her. And then in book three, there's that metaphor of the toothache, right? He's like somebody who's had a painful tooth and now it's extracted. He's over her, he says, but he wants to have justice. He thinks that still it's right that she should be punished.
Right.
So none of these things are pretty, right? But you can, but we're made, I think, to see the natural origin of these feelings, and that they come. Not that he has wrenched the situation to make them feel that way, but they come over him in this way. So this is in book three, where he chooses to keep her, not to divorce her, not to denounce her, but to command her to break off the affair, and thereby to torture her, But then we see that he justifies it to himself religiously, and that worries us. We see, a trait in him that is a little ugly and is likely to get uglier. But then nonetheless, in the very next chapter, I'm talking about book 3, chapter 14, he writes a letter to her. And read the letter. It's a letter that is carefully correct. You can't say the man is wrong, I'm sorry, I didn't check the page number.
259.
Sorry, 2?
259.
Thank you. There as his right, having carefully and fully considered everything, etc., etc. My decision is as follows. Whatever your actions may have been, I do not consider myself justified in severing the bonds with which a higher power has united us. A family must not be broken up through the caprice, perversity, or even crime of one of the married couple, and our life must go on as heretofore. This is unavoidable for my sake, for yours, and for that of our son. Somebody has to remember all this stuff. Nobody else is remembering it. Right? This is what duty is. Nobody else sees it, and it's not. Mm-hmm.
But isn't Tolstoy also playing with the question of a marriage versus the wedding? Mm-hmm. I mean, you see this with Levin and Kitty when they're getting married. All the women are talking about their wedding days, but you're made to understand that their marriages are not exactly ideal. It's not so much of finding a partner, so much as a societal convenience, in order to attain a place in society. There's this question of whether Kitty's going to be an old maid, and Levin is tormented with the thought that she's marrying him, just to avoid that problem.
Yep.
Well, there's a question of his jealousy, of course.
Yes.
But look at the contrast between the wedding and there's subsequent, the first months when they have to get to know one another. Mm-hmm. And in the wedding, you notice that they're awkward, they don't know what to do. The priest has to, they have to redo the rings because they do it all wrong, and the dolly has to come up and help out, and they have to say, no, you do this here, you put this here, and so on. They're very much in love, they're a little overcome.
Mm-hmm.
They don't understand the ritual. And they don't understand that marriage is, in a way, getting to learn the routine and the ritual. And so for the first few months, they get into arguments and all this. And then, of course, they forgive one another right away, and they go on. But so the thing that's interesting about Tolstoy is that he really doesn't give anybody in the novel very much of a chance to be utterly and completely perfect. Sorry. But the thing about Kitty is that she is perfectly happy to go off and live in the country. She doesn't care about Petersburg society or Moscow society. She's perfectly happy to be there alone and with her family and with their estate. And this is something that is a little surprising. We don't quite expect that. So there are all kinds of unexpected things. After the wedding, which we think it's cute that they get, sort of lost in the ceremony, and they don't quite know what they're supposed to do, what's being demanded of them at this moment. And we suspect that it's going to take them a little while to sort out the marriage as a result, because they don't know the routine. But then at the same time, we recognize that they have a capacity to learn from one another and to learn from others. And of course, with Levin, it's at the moment of his brother's final illness and death that he really sees what Kitty is for the first time. So it's in confrontation with the most important and the last things, finding that people show themselves for what they really are.
Beautiful stuff.
Yes.
So the whole counterpoint with Kitty and Levin is, of course, interstitched by, mm-hmm. by Tolstoy in this way, and sometimes in really, really telling ways.
Have I gone too far?
No. That's the thing about where we're at.
Before we go back. Not so sure.
Where you should be at by now. All right. So we'll have to say that the question of Karenin is a complex one. He's headed, like everyone else connected with Anna, headed downward, but that he is a man who is conscious very much of duty. And also, if we're building a Western notion of the independent worth of the individual woman, he seems to be much more correct in that notion than anyone else in the novel. Right? If you're going to, so think about that as we decide social policy. Let's think about Vronsky. If we say there's been nobody who is fault free. There is one person whom Tolstoy just dumps everything on, and this is Vronsky, who is the attractive man with his white polished teeth, right, and his hairy chest, and his virility. He was played by Sean Connery, a young Sean Connery in the Hollywood making of this movie.
Well, what did he and Karenin have in common? Did you notice that?
Their names, like people actually remark on their
names.
Uh-huh.
But in addition to that,
they both refer to their teeth being straight and white.
Yeah.
Isn't Karenin's bald and Vronsky has a receding hairline?
Yeah.
But
I'm not thinking of something physical. I'm thinking of something of a personality trait of sorts. Yeah, they're both ambitious, and they both lose out, don't they? And they lose out by miscalculating. Both of them do. And of course, Vronsky has already lost out, but he hasn't lost out totally. But then he seems to sacrifice his future. He leaves the military to Anna. What does Karenin sacrifice? Just trying to weight it on the other side a little bit here.
Mm-hmm. What? Do tell.
Well, I don't know. What does he give up?
Well, I mean, that's the whole theme of his relationship, right? Is it's basically on rails, and his motive behind everything is to keep everything stable and how it has been, whatever, and to keep himself comfortable, basically.
Yeah.
That's why he arranges things in that way, is because that's, I don't know if his character's complex. It's not like a caricature like Dickens, but in that regard, that's his flaw. Whereas, Vronsky is kind of admirable because he actually does make a sacrifice for her. Whereas Karenin, I don't think really does.
And yet, you notice how in that comment, I forget whom I was quoting at the time, but the notion that there is a comfort zone that society provides through a kind of unspoken ritual and expectations. And you notice that Karenin and Anna and Levin and Kitty and a number of these characters, as soon as they get out of that comfort zone, they have a problem. They don't quite understand what they're supposed to do next. Tell me what I'm supposed to do next. And so they're off the rails.
Well, Vronsky's always decisive. Like that's
he is.
There's a whole section about that when he's doing his accounting or whatever. Mm-hmm. That he's, it says that his system of values wasn't really consistent. It didn't make sense, but it was energetic, right? Mm-hmm. And so he was never indecisive about anything. He would just kind of forge ahead.
And he seems to have everything in his estate in hand, mm-hmm. and well managed.
Well, what he intends, his code of principles, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it turns out to be quite different from his reality.
Yeah.
And one of our earliest clues though certainly the strongest early clue is the horse race. And notice, remember that paragraph when Frou Frou, the mare, is introduced, and she's described in detail. And we see really in a cynical way, this is the way he sees Anna as well, right? It's the same. Right? So the break, he moves in the wrong way and breaks her back. You know, it's a terrible, agonizing scene.
Is it really that easy to ride horses?
Well, horses are, you know, look how they're structured.
just recently it was demonstrated that horses were never built to be ridden on. their backs are not structured to support even the weight of a jockey.
Really?
Yeah.
So just feel bad about them from here on.
Yeah. And then with that terrible detail of he kicks the horse when it's down because he's so angry, he's so caught up by an indescribable emotion, and the horse just looks at him with those eyes. And we know this is an author who's written a whole story that's from the point of view of a horse. You know, kind of a Rousseauist horse. but this is just a real horse.
And we think of the horses in Dostoevsky too at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we sure do. Horses are loci of suffering in the Russian novel. Mm-hmm. Well, we have that chapter that talks about his code of principles, right? And we see that they're all self-contradictory, right? And they give the advantage to an adulterer, and make a noble man out of an adulterer, and a fool out of a husband, and so forth. And it goes on, in a masterful way enunciating this. And then it says, well, but Anna with child, Anna pregnant, my code doesn't cover this. This is not in his code. And we have that wonderful chapter at the beginning of book four in which he's required to squire around a foreign prince. And this foreign prince is terribly crass, right? Although a noble man, also by any distinction, and he recognizes himself in that. There was also an earlier moment when Vronsky said that he feels an indescribable sense of loathing, right? And it's including for himself, right? And this foreign prince makes him see, is this all I am? He's my... Constance Garnett translation, I think yours has him say, stupid ox. I like the Constance Garnett because he says, brainless beef, is that all I am? So there's this war inside himself that is you know, of a certain amount of interest, you got to say. In one short chapter at the beginning, right after that, in book four, chapter two, Anna commands Vronsky to come see her. Now we see Anna, of course, always has the upper hand in this relationship. Vronsky has a dream, an unsettling dream, about a man bending over and muttering French. You know, creepy. And he meets Karenin unexpectedly at the doorway and knows at that moment that it's Karenin's nonviolence toward him that puts him in the wrong. Right? If Karenin were at all going to be aggressive toward him, he could... rally himself and say, you know, I'm standing up, but he can't do that. So he's confused. He doesn't know, as you're saying, he's off the rails. What comes next?
He wants a duel.
He wants one, right? And Karenin's not going to give him the pleasure. Right? And then they meet in that chapter, a very short chapter, and it ends with Anna gazing in his face and says, trying to make the two images come together. Do you remember that? The image that she has in her mind of him, which is impossibly ideal and wonderful, and the real image there that she has in front of him. So, yeah, that's, you know, it's well, he picks the most telling details of a false relationship, right? Then she says in the next chapter that she's had a dream, a terrible dream, and it turns out to be pretty much the same dream. Tolstoy gets away with some of these creepy effects that are inexplicable. But this is quite worrisome. And then we're tossed away from that as she feels the baby stir, and they both are lost in the bliss of the moment at the end of the chapter ends. So we're tossed from extreme to extreme. The ominousness gets quickly forgotten, yet it comes back. Once they have the scene in which she asks forgiveness of her husband, and she acts so self-forgetting, and the husband acts so magnanimous and everything. Vronsky is lost. He doesn't know what to do. He goes back. He's humiliated. Goes back to his room and says there's only one solution. Tries to shoot himself and misses. You know, Tolstoy is merciless toward the poor guy. At some point, you really do feel kind of sorry for him. He turns from a big impressive man into a schlub as he goes on. And I think about this, and we talked about this as self-sacrifice. But what does he do? He unmans himself for her. He is a career soldier. He resigns from the army to go off with her. So he kisses his future goodbye. And from that point on, the stress is in the relationship that he says he no longer senses himself to be, to have any will. You know, he can only do what she wants. He so manly a man had indeed with her no will of his own, it says in book 5. And this is right at the time where, this is right around the time of the wedding of Levin and Kitty. So a terrific change, happening, terrific contrast between the two.
Is this what beautiful women do to men? Corinne and Brodsky.
Oh my. And, you know, it's a series of renunciations. He tries painting, he gives up painting, and so forth. So here we have Vronsky is starts out not so wonderful, but is really increasingly destroyed as he goes on. So meanwhile, we have Levin, right? And all the counterpoint of Levin is, which is, you know, again, what a novel can do, as you take a rising pattern and a falling pattern together. And this is a wonderful one. You've hit on the major points, Scott, that sense of death that comes over him at the country, anytime that he's close to his brother who is dying, right, he has that sense of confronting a nothingness that is too big for him that he can't possibly face, and yet he's obsessed with it. When we see him at the beginning of book 4, he's been contemplating the nothingness of death. And but just before that, of course, he's been wondering, you know, how am I to change my life? Should I go off and work in the country? Is this my calling in life? How am I going to do it? And then suddenly Kitty appears, right? And only Tolstoy can get away with this, right? She just appears. She rides by. She's in the coach. And he sees her, and this is an epiphany, right? And that's his answer. And as he says at the end of that chapter, I love her. So goodbye, country. Hello, Kitty. Don't you think the game of the initials is charming? I mean, you know, obviously it is, but you find it a little too sweet, huh? I think it's nice.
Well, yeah, but think for a moment what's happened here, because he's just come out of a somewhat Dostoevskian discussion, little bit of polyphony. On chapter 13, 360s, look at the bottom. Levin had often noticed in arguments among the most intelligent people that after expending enormous efforts and an immense number of logical subtleties and words, the disputants at last became conscious of the fact the thing they had been such pains to prove to one another had long ago, from the very beginning of the controversy, been known to them, but that they liked different things and were inclined to mention what they like, lest it should be attacked. So when you finally open yourself up to somebody else, you say, well, actually, you know, I have a soft spot for this. And he said he had experienced the fact that sometimes in the middle of a discussion, one understands what it is that one's opponent likes and suddenly likes it oneself and immediately agrees with him. But all proofs become superfluous and unnecessary. And then sometimes the opposite happens. But then all of a sudden, they realize that they're both projecting the same story. See, that's what's happened here. That's why they can use just the initials of the words. They both are thinking exactly on the same track. They haven't quite realized this, because courting is a kind of game of opposition. You know, you're testing out the other person back and forth. And so if they had made the words overt, you see, then it would have been sort of satire, I think. But the point here is that there's something that's been submerged in all this. Kitty really has loved him. She just hasn't admitted it quite to herself.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as you set out that structure in language, but with you
parts
know, the
left
significant
out.
Parts of words hidden, then all of a sudden they realize they're reading one another's minds.
Yeah, and all of this, of course, goes back to the first sentence of the novel as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Happy families are all alike.
Yeah. And all think alike. Yeah. Say the same things.
So that's their increasing harmony contrasts to what's going on with Anna and Vronsky terrifically. Even in the bumpy moments, as you were talking about, it says that they have, Levin and Kitty have a bitter and humiliating honeymoon. Right? But this is at the same time that Anna and Vronsky have gone off to Italy, and Anna says she's deliriously happy. So, and yet they get bored very soon. They both have ennui. Vronsky has ennui, and Levin has ennui. But Levin's ennui, leads him to his dying brother, which he has been unable to cope with. And there is where Kitty comes out and busies herself immediately. She knows immediately what to do. So this is a marriage, right, in which she has unlocked, she has provided the part of his life that he has been unable to cope with. And it's a marriage because love goes outward, right? It's not turned inward as it is with Anna and with Vronsky. So, I think that's a profound moment there that we're going to end with this time. Now, next time, we're going to go on to Book 7, Chapter 4, and then on Thursday, to all the way to the end, as we will also be talking a bit about the exam.
Would you be able to give us a study guide?
Yes, I will.
That would be very helpful.
Oh, by the way, I did put a very detailed chronology of Tolstoy's life from the Cambridge Guide to Tolstoy on Blackboard. I don't know if you've noticed it. There are a few optical character recognition errors.
What is the
very
next time? Is it over? Are we doing next time over half of the book or the entire book? Or?
5, 6.
Okay, so like page 500.